Blog Talk Radio.
Live to see it, friends. You're listening to Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. Fast Forward Radio is an audio production of The Speculist, and you'll find us online at speculist.com. That's S-P-E-C-U-L-I-S-T.com. Or go straight to the blog at blog.speculist.com. At The Speculist and on Fast Forward Radio, we are all about a convergence of emerging technologies and emerging possibilities, which is at the heart of this, the greatest period of transformation in human history. Our world is changing in ways that are hard to predict, sometimes even hard to imagine. And Fast Forward Radio is your guide to an astounding future that lies ahead and that will be here sooner than you think. My name is Phil Bauermaster, and with me in the virtual studio is my co-blogger, co-futurist, and co-host, Stephen Gordon. Hello, Stephen.
Hey, Phil. How are you?
Well, I am super fantastic. How are you doing, my friend?
I'm doing excellent. Doing very good. But then again, I'm not having to travel, so...
Yeah, well, we were just talking about this before the show started. Here I am. I'm back on the road again. And last time I was on the road, it didn't end well. You know, I came home from a 2-day road trip and ended up in the hospital. So I'm hoping not to have a repeat of that.
Stay away from the hot dog carts or whatever it was that.
we'll never get to the bottom of that. You know, there's a lot of attention that's been paid to the fact that I had sushi my second night, but nobody else who had it got sick, and we were all eating off the same plate. So, I don't know what it is, but my wife has just told me to be Purelling myself all the time. So that's kind of my major line of defense.
You know, walk around as Bubble Boy, you know.
That's what I said. I said, look, if I'm going to California again, I'm wearing a hazmat suit, okay? I think that's about the only way I can really be safe. But so what's new with you? Seen any good movies?
Well, I took the kids to see Shrek this weekend, and, you know, my expectations were not particularly high. I really, really liked the first one. I thought it was a good one. The second one I liked less. The third one I merely tolerated. And so, I figured, you know, we're on a downhill slide. They're getting they're milking this for all the mileage they can get out of parents with kids, you know.
Yep.
They turned in a sequel here that's worthy of the original movie. It was really good. Yeah, it's very good. If you happen to ever get around to watching the first one and thought it was great and then were disappointed by any of the sequels, this was good. This was and apparently it's supposed to be the last one, but you know how that is. As long as they're making money with these things, they'll probably continue to put them out. So, you know, fortunately, this was a good one, and so you're not wasting.
Well,
your
isn't
money
it called like the final chapter or something like that?
Yeah,
at the end of
Well, I'll remind you of the third Indiana Jones movie. You know, so the Last Crusade. So.
Well, yeah, but that was the Last Crusade. That was the, you know, the end of the Crusades because they found the Holy Grail. I mean, that had nothing to do with it being the final Indiana Jones movie. Clearly, we had to wait 20 years and get that interesting thing we saw last summer.
Oh, yeah, it was that was interesting, but it was exactly. Yeah, everyone always knew that that fourth one was coming, you know, as Harrison gets older and older. But,
yeah. I doubt we'll have a fifth one. What do you think? You think the fifth one's in the works? I don't think so.
No, I think that pretty much cap the series. It was a pretty good movie. It had problems, but it was not because Harrison Ford was too old. It was just, I don't know. It was strange, I guess.
It is hard to get the magic back. Now, I saw a trailer the other night. Went to see Iron Man with my daughter.
Oh, yeah.
And Iron Man was excellent, but the trailer I saw was for – have you seen this kind of a teaser trailer? Because the movie's not coming out until next summer, a movie called Super 8.
Super 8. Is that a Spielberg movie?
It is, yes. Steven Spielberg is, I think, the executive producer, and J.J. Abrams is directing. So You get no information at all except that it has something to do with Area 51. It has something to do with aliens. There's a really cool of a scene of a train wreck in the teaser, and the whole thing just has a real kind of Close Encounters of the Third Kind feel to it. Only it looks like this time they're not friendly, right? And I keep thinking that Spielberg's kind of going back to his roots. You know, that's what he was always really originally interested in. He did E.T. and Close Encounters, and he sort of tied that idea in with Indiana Jones in that last Indiana Jones movie. And now here he is coming back making another UFO movie. So I'm kind of looking forward to that. I think that might be a lot of fun.
Oh yeah, yeah. He's got my dollar already. You know.
I'll definitely.
I mean $15, but.
And that's just the popcorn right there, you know.
Yeah, that's right. That's not even the price of admission anymore.
For $15.
And if you're buying 3D glasses, save your 3D glasses, by the way. A little advice to the audience there. If you've got kids, then it seems like every single movie for kids nowadays, just about, is a 3D movie. And
right.
And if you're lucky, they run you only $3 a pop on the glasses. And so, you know, if you're outfitting your whole family with those, they always encourage you, you know, to throw those glasses in the recycle bin. Yeah.
Right.
So they can sell them again to you next time you come.
That's a ripoff. They used to give them away free. Now they're selling them, huh?
Yeah. $3 a piece. And so, I say a better way to recycle it is keep them and then use them again. I don't even have to wrap it in plastic again. You know, I mean, that's
there you go. That's right.
More economically and certainly environmentally friendly.
Save the planet. Reuse your 3D glasses. By golly, there. Now that's a meme. Okay, you have just introduced a meme.
A valuable meme.
You've kicked this. You've kicked this over into our major topic of the evening. But actually, before we go there. I cannot access the chat room. I just need to check with you. Is Sally there?
Sally is not in the chat room tonight.
Oh, okay. Well, we were remiss in not welcoming Sally back last week, so I wanted to welcome her back this week. But if she's not there, we'll have to save it until she's here. So if she shows up, we'll welcome her back, I suppose. Anyway, we're really pleased to have Sally back. Just didn't get around to – we were so – just the way we brought our guest on last week precluded a lot of stuff up front, so we didn't get a chance to do it.
Alex was an awesome guest. Once we brought him in, I mean it was full speed ahead, wasn't it?
Boom, we jumped right into it. Yeah, and it was a great time having him on. I look forward to having him on again sometime soon. So, so let's get into our topic a little bit. We're going to be talking about the title I gave tonight is How to Start a Meme, and you'll be intrigued to learn that I have no idea how to start a meme. Okay, I have a couple thoughts, and we'll get to those at the end. But if anyone's tuning in expecting a step by step set of instructions. All I can tell you is look how effective my marketing has been, right, that I got you in here. But now I'm ruining it by admitting we don't have it. No, there will be something. We will talk about how to start a meme at the end. But really, wanted to talk a little bit about this idea of memes. We've probably done, what, 3 or 4 shows on this over the course of the Fast Forward Radio?
Richard Dawkins is the guy who invented the concept back in the 70s. He wrote a book called The Selfish Gene. And he introduced the idea that the idea that ideas could work much like life, that genes are selfish. They are looking only to perpetuate themselves, and they respond to pressures. Well, ideas work the same way. Was what he put out in that book, and. And by doing so, he created a whole field of study, really.
Absolutely. And it's he wanted to give an example of something else that worked the same as genes. These genes that, as you said, they simply seek to perpetuate, apparently, as though they had a will, as though they had behavior, which isn't really the case. This is a metaphorical description. But they apparently seek to replicate themselves, to reproduce themselves, and really are interested only in doing that. And he wanted to give another example of something that worked that way. And so he came up with the idea of the meme, which is an idea that reproduces itself the same way genes do. And it creates this really interesting question about what we all have rattling around inside our heads. And that question is, well, because we like to think that we have browsed the marketplace of ideas, right? We've weighed and considered all the options, and we've said, I choose this belief, I reject that belief, right? Because this belief makes sense to me, and it sorts well with my values, and it is logically and obviously true, and therefore this is what I believe. That belief doesn't sort well with my values. It does not present itself as being true, and I reject it. And maybe that's not what's going on at all. Maybe we've been infected with these highly reproducible ideas that have gotten a hold of us, and they take us where they want to go. And I posted.
Well,
go ahead.
I was just going to say, that's obviously putting a very negative spin on it. Some ideas are obviously very valuable to us, and that's one of the reasons why an idea could spread, is that it's just a very valuable way of looking at the world, and maybe it gives us some sense of meaning, things like that. So, yeah, there are obviously positive memes, and then there are others that are not so positive, and we'll probably get into that too.
Yeah, well, I had linked this TED Talk from Dan Dennett, and I don't know if you got a chance to sit through that. Actually, it was Wayne Rudinsky who had published a comment on it on Facebook, and I think maybe I had seen it a couple years back, but it really kind of caught my attention this time around for whatever reason. And he starts out talking about it gives a really interesting story about an ant that you might see climbing up to the top of a blade of grass and then back down and then back up. Did you happen to watch the video, Stephen?
I think I've watched it one time.
You've seen it before, okay.
I've watched all the TED Talks. I mean, talk about a great meme factory there.
Well, TED, ideas worth spreading, right? I mean, it's a meme factory. So he's talking about this ant engaging in this very bizarre behavior. He says, what good is it doing the ant? He says, it's doing the ant no good whatsoever. He'll continue in that behavior until he drops dead, starves to death, or very likely is eaten by a predator, by a bird. Now, why does this ant engage in this behavior? Is it just a fluke? And he says, yes, it's just a fluke. And he shows a picture of this fluke worm, which is a parasite that inhabits this ant, takes over its nervous system, and makes it engage in that behavior. The ant is then eaten by a bird and puts the fluke into the bird's digestive system, which allows the fluke to move on to its next stage of its life cycle. So there are actually a number of examples of these kinds of parasites that take control of, you would
zombie.
Almost have to describe.
Zombify their, yeah.
Yeah, zombify, yeah. Like more sophisticated hosts make them engage in elaborate behavior, all for the benefit of the reproduction of the parasite. And from Dennett's standpoint, that is a good analogy for memes. So they can get a hold of people and have them engage in not only non-beneficial behavior, but ultimately, in the case of this ant, completely self-destructive behavior, because the ant ends, it's like self-nullifying behavior. The ant ends up either dying of starvation or being eaten. So
there are examples of memes that can do that to people. The suicide bomber is a good example of that. In certain very rural areas, there are still Christian sects that handle snakes and do dangerous things like that. Other Christian sects also refuse to get medical treatment, for various illnesses because it shows a lack of faith to do so. Those types of memes If you get thoroughly infected with something like that, it is not good. It's not good for your
health.
Your,
you know, I mean,
not good for your health at all.
From a rational,
you're not long for the world. You know, you really got a good case of that. You know.
Yeah, from a purely rational standpoint, and you know, without either A, in understanding the spiritual benefit, or B, having been infected by the meme, however you want to look at it, it's hard to see any self. It's hard to see any benefit to the self of handling a poisonous snake. You know, I mean, that's, you know, the snake will bite you, and then you'll have poison in your body. You know, I mean, it's. But I think the suicide bomber, or really the suicide anything, is the ultimate example, right? That's where where a meme really is a lot like this flukeworm. It's just going to take you and to whatever purpose it's trying to achieve. In the case of the suicide bomber, to you know, take out a bunch of other people, and you look at these copycat mass murder incidents that you see, where somebody will show up at a workplace or a public place and start shooting people and then turn the gun on themselves. I mean, that is a, you know, that is an idea that has copied itself through people's behavior. And it's definitely, you know, not only bad for the individual who engages in it, but it's really bad for everyone around them, as is the suicide bomber example. So I think that definitely those exist. There definitely are memes like that seem to be completely powerful and that will reproduce themselves at the expense of the life of the person who is their carrier. But the question is, are they all like that? They don't all kill you, but are all the ideas that we have in our heads, do they all fit into that category? And I don't suppose that that's actually what Dan Dennett is saying. But at one point, he starts throwing some out there, and one of the memes that he mentions is the state slogan, I think, for New Hampshire, live free or die. Is that New Hampshire?
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, I believe
okay.
So. That's right. That's correct. Obviously, now here we're in a gray area, okay, because obviously if you know, you're a patriotic person and you have this idea that, you know, I will, you know, I'll gladly give my life to preserve the freedom that we enjoy in this country. Now, is that a good thing or is that a bad thing? Well, for the person individually, obviously, that doesn't necessarily, if what you're looking for in life is a long life, then perhaps that's not the best meme for you if you're looking to live a long time. Now, the counter argument to that is, you know, well, what about the meaning that gives me? You know, I mean, we all die. What's the phrase in Braveheart? Every man dies, not every man truly lives. You know?
Right. Right.
And so if you're, you know, you want your life to have meaning and you lay it down so as to preserve freedom for others, then, you know, maybe that's not the worst sort of life to have had. So, you know, I guess there's a couple of ways to look at that.
Yeah, but is that all true, or are you just rationalizing a meme you've been infected with? that's the problem. Is,
well, you know, I think we have some choice in the memes that we take on.
Okay.
You know,
all right.
I mean,
and that's where we're going with this. That's actually where this where this conversation is going. Because
I think we all handle memes. You know, I mean, we all look them over and we try them on sometimes, and then we discard them. And I would say that by the time you're in your middle years, you're just loaded up with memes, and you only occasionally get a new one. You know. It's you're living with 30 and 40 year old memes sometimes, you know, as you advance through your middle years. But when you're very young, you know, let's say when you leave high school and go off to college, you're trying on lots of memes during that period of time.
Right. Well,
deciding what kind of person you're going to be.
To me, here's what was interesting about this is live free or die comes up, and basically that is presented as symptomatic of a toxic mimetic infection, that the idea live free or die is basically offered up as equivalent to the suicide bomber, okay? And the audience, pretty much, you know, the ones who were vocal about it anyway, seem to agree that there are no ideas worth dying for, or that if you believe that there are ideas worth dying for, that that indicates that you've caught this particular meme, and you've caught a toxic meme. But it seems to me that we're at a level of abstraction with this one, that we aren't with, you know, I'm going to go kill a bunch of infidels, right? I mean, to me, that's specific. The notion that some things might be worth dying for is more general. And I think, well, so is every philosophical proposition that anyone has just an example of is it just like that fluke worm that took over the ant? And I don't see how it could be, because it seems to me that the idea that there are no ideas worth dying for is just as likely a mimetic infection as the idea that there are ideas worth dying for. I mean, right? If my ideas are just a reflection of a mind virus that I caught, why aren't yours? Now, the response to that would be, but the response to that would be, yeah, but yours is going to get you killed, you see. Right. Right. Well, I think that would be the answer.
And the answer to that is that it was that phrase from Braveheart. You're going to die anyway. All you guys with this idea that there's no idea worth dying for, you're going to die too.
Right.
You will have stood for nothing. You will have stood for nothing, and you will be just as dead. You might be, you know, a little later coming to it, but you'll be dead too. And so that would be the response to that. So, you know, so who's infected? You know, that's I think we all have memes that we're infected with. And we get, and to some extent, we can choose what those memes are. And we can pick through them and discard some that, you know, maybe you know, as generations go by, you can decide at some point in your life what memes you're going to carry from your parents and which ones can just go. You know, I think that's an important point in maturing. You know, is when you decide, you know, that idea that mom and dad had, I'm going to leave that one.
This one I like, and some of them you find you like later, right? You didn't like them so much
earlier.
Right.
You come back to it. It turns out mom and dad weren't so stupid.
Right,
and you come back to that, but then there's some that you just never pick up again, you know?
Yeah, that's right. You go, nah.
Nah, that's not necessary.
Don't need it, yeah. I think that's true. I think even if we really are just carrying out programs, just like mindlessly executing programs, which I doubt, it certainly feels like we're choosing them, and we maintain the illusion, the fiction anyway, that people are choosing their own memes. We, you know, in order for society to operate, you almost have to assume that people have free will and that they're picking out their beliefs. Now, there was a great, speaking of will, there was a great comment from Will Brown on that post. He writes, on the idea worth dying for issue, I wonder if a given expression or instantiation of an idea being worth dying for might be a better statement of the sentiment. It's quite easy to imagine how a given example of the idea of nationhood might or might not be considered, and he quotes, worth dying for. I suspect very few German soldiers assigned to the Eastern Front in February of 1943 were all that fervent to die for National Socialism. But I'm a convinced skeptic. That they were soldiers at all makes it likely they were at least willing to run the risk of doing so. Is even a bad application of an idea worthy of risking death to defend? A question I would like the chance to put to any of my surviving Vietnamese competition, as was sometime. My initial suspicion is that an idea's worth is directly correlatable to the extent of an individual's sense of investment or self or other worth therein. And I think, I think that's exactly right, that we have values that are pushing us to select one meme and reject another meme. And it's not a perfect process, but I think at some level, even the people who go like shoot up a McDonald's, right, or go shoot up their workplace, there's some level of engagement on their part, right? It's not just the fluke that got a hold of the ant. These people aren't completely zombies. At least I don't think they are. Certainly when I look at my own life, I think that there's this real tension between, or not tension, there's this real spectrum from ideas that I've probably just absorbed and really do work more or less as computer programming to things that I've struggled with and come to one conclusion or another and even vacillate on, where sometimes I feel one way and sometimes I feel the other way.
Sometimes it's possible. I really think it's possible for us to hold within ourselves contradictory memes.
Okay, can you give an example of that? That's interesting.
Let me see if I can. I think that there are people that when they are in a religious circumstance, like mm-hmm. when they go to church or something, they are fervent believers. And then they behave a totally different way when they're outside of those religious circumstances.
Oh, okay. And that applies to a lot of other kinds of behaviors and contexts too. Yeah. Okay.
Absolutely. I mean, you and are you being two-faced? Well, you know, I think that we are capable of living great hypocrisy, you know, and not even be self-aware enough to know it sometimes. That, you know, we hold ourselves out to be certain ways, and we even convince ourselves that we are certain ways in certain circumstances, but then we behave in totally different ways under slightly different circumstances. So, yeah.
I think that's entirely true. If you ever read 1984, George Orwell talks about this idea of double think, which the state imposes on the citizens of Oceania, whatever the country was called. Come to think of it, that's not imposed on them. What's imposed on them is a certain set of facts that must be accepted as true. And doublethink becomes this strategy that some of citizens there adopt, which makes it possible for them to survive within that world, because they will accept as absolutely true certain things that they also know are not true, right? That weren't true last week, or that probably won't be true again in 2 weeks, because it's this totalitarian state, and the truth is this moving target. So you've got this cognitive dissonance between what they factually know to be true and what they have accepted to be true because they must. I think that describes what people get themselves, a mode that people in real life do get themselves into in political settings and religious, at the workplace, within families. There's any number of situations where you believe one thing because you should, and then you believe something else that's very different from that because you actually think that's what's true, and or because it's more convenient or it's easier, or, you know, whatever the distinction might be. But it seems to me that people have an almost endless capacity to keep kind of conflicting, if not outright contradictory, ideas in their head. Sometimes one wins out clearly over the others, and sometimes we just have this kind of interesting battle going on between them. And it's not necessarily a bad thing. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Sally has joined us in the chat room, and we wanted to welcome her back.
Sally, we're so pleased to have you back, and I'm sorry we weren't able to give you a proper welcome back last week, but the place is not the same without you. So thanks for stepping in and helping to run our chat this evening. And I wish I could see what you're writing about, but I'm on a computer network that won't allow me to access the chat room tonight. So please be kind, I guess. And be careful with those memes you start spreading there in the chat room. Well, okay. So all of this leads us, before we talk about the second of those two videos, I want to take a sidestep to a particular meme that I've taken rather strong issue with. You saw my blog post, Jeremy Irons is a nitwit.
Yeah. Well, you know, you took issue with another meme five arguments against four arguments against immortality just right before that. So I mean,
that's true. I guess I'm feisty, man. I've gotten all feisty here in my post illness. I suppose. Although I didn't call Annalie any names, and I do want to say that I regret calling Jeremy Irons a nitwit. That's not my usual style. We don't usually attack people in the blog, and I've always been a a big admirer of his work. Reversal of Fortune in particular, I thought was excellent, and he's been in a lot of good stuff. So as an actor, I think he's awesome. What's that?
I was just, you have no idea. I remember that line when you are a strange man at the very end.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know,
yeah.
I have no idea.
Yeah, he delivers that very convincingly. I agree. Yeah. I love that last scene where he walks into the drugstore and says, "A vial of insulin, please." Just kidding. That's so creepy.
Yeah.
Anyway, so, okay, great actor. I think a very flawed spokesman on global issues. Now, I took him to task for his view that basically the same scenario that we saw in that horrible movie. What was it, 2 years ago? Called the Happening. M. Night Shyamalan.
Yeah.
Right?
In
that movie, nature rises up and smites humanity for all of our offenses against nature. And I think that's a dumb idea for any number of reasons. But here's this quote from Jeremy Irons.
I felt like the filmmaker was rising up and slapping me just because he could. Cause he had already
forever having admired him, you know?
Yes, that's right. Like, yeah.
You know, 10 years ago, we all thought M. Night Shyamalan was the greatest thing ever, and he's been punishing us for it ever since, I think. not true. I really liked Unbreakable. Okay. So
yeah,
the first
that
two,
was good.
And then it's been kind of spotty ever since. But we're not here to talk about movies. I want to talk about what Jeremy Irons says. Here's what he wrote, or what he said. "One always returns to the fact that there are just too many of us. The population continues to rise, and it's unsustainable," he said in an interview with the Sunday Times. "I think we have to find ways where we're not having to scrap our affluent junk and are a really sustainable planet. Natural systems of self-regulation may stop population growth. I suspect there will be a big outbreak of something because the world always takes care of itself." The 61-year-old actor went on to speculate that either disease or war, probably disease, could become could become nature's way of having the population. Now, okay.
Here's my problem. There's my first problem with it is people that talk like that are always elitist. They never see themselves as part of the problem. Okay, they never see themselves as the person that really needs to be eliminated. You know, because
right.
I suppose there might be a few people out there that feel the way Jeremy Irons does and have taken action and by committing suicide. But I would say that they're by far the exceptions.
To be clear, we don't want anyone to, okay?
No, because we completely
disagree. It's fine with me if you
want
to be a hypocrite about it. But just recognize that you're a hypocrite, I think, is the...
Yeah, if you're affected with this particular idea and you're not committing suicide, then you are a hypocrite. Stay a hypocrite, stay alive, because it's a stupid idea. Get rid of the idea, and you'll be less of a nitwit.
Yeah, if there are too many people on the planet, and we're living in an unsustainable way. Okay, Jeremy Irons, it says here in the story, has 7 houses. Okay, so he is the unsustainable person, okay? I mean,
yeah, exactly. If everyone on the earth had 7 houses, there would be no, green space anywhere, so.
Right, right. I mean, he is the offender, okay? And really what happens when a horrible natural disaster occurs, you know what? It doesn't hit the people with the big carbon footprints. I mean, indiscriminately, it hits everybody. But you think about the tsunami in 2005, right? All those people in Southeast Asia, people in Indonesia, Thailand, other parts of the world, other countries in that region, who were killed, hundreds of thousands of people who were killed, these are people with a low carbon footprint. Okay, these are people who were not big offenders. These were people who probably come much closer to living the sustainable, quote-unquote sustainable lifestyle than any of the rest of us. It just doesn't work that way. Nature does not smite humanity for our offenses against nature. For one thing, we don't have time to get into it tonight, but I personally believe that humanity is nature's best friend, and we're really partners with nature in making cool things happen.
Well,
but even if you want to,
we are a product of nature. I mean, you know, come on. Nature is trying out sentience. You know, hey, give us a break. We're part of the deal. You know. Anyway,
exactly. So I find it really unattractive when people can theorize about the deaths of billions of people in a quasi approvingly, if not outright approving way. Especially because earlier he's talking about how appalled he is by the fact that there are a billion people who are hungry in the world. And I think we all should be appalled by that. And we should all want to solve that problem. Because when we see our fellow human beings suffering, we should have empathy to that and want to do something about that. We should not sit around thinking, you know, this planet would be a lot better off if, I don't know, there was a big disaster that wiped out half of us. To me, that is morally indefensible, okay? That is a horrible way to view the world, and it's monstrous to look at the world that way. Now, I think in defense of Jeremy Irons, I don't really think he wants that to happen. He talks like he does. I mean, it sounds like he does, but I really don't think he's thought it through. And, you know, the point is when people die, it's like when – what's the Stalin quote, right? You know, one death is a tragedy, a million deaths is a statistic, right? When you talk about billions of people dying, it's like it's easy to be glib and, you know, very theoretical and abstract about it. You know, when one person who's close to you is struck down by a disease or dies in an accident, you think how terrible and horrible that is. To multiply that a billion or two or three times over, and to be on the side of that is just, you know, I can't think of a correct way to describe it. Monstrous is the word that comes to mind. But I don't think he is. Okay, let me just put it back. In the end, I stuck to my initial diagnosis, nitwit, and I do apologize for using that term, nitwit. But I think that it's just not well thought out. But it is a great example of, I think, a meme, an idea that he has selected, but that has also, to a certain extent, gotten a hold of him. Because it seems to me that once an idea like this gets a hold of people, they're not clear in the distinction that they ought to be clear in between something like, well, I'm concerned about people. I don't want them to starve to death, but and yet I do want them, you know, to be wiped out in a natural catastrophe. It doesn't make sense. So I had a nice discussion with Mike D in the comments of this, and this is like share comments night. We got great comments this past week on the blog, and Mike comes back with this response. I think that that to fantasize about this is the words I use were creepy and deranged. And Mike writes back, he says, how far can creepy and deranged go before it is stopped by more powerful external forces?
Right.
If I don't take a sick day and then stand a little too close in your cube at work, am I perpetrating an act of biological warfare? If I infect you and others with an absurd meme, should I be held accountable for any eventual shift in groupthink? Is the point that nitwits are only dangerous en masse? How many like-minded nitwits does it take to become dangerous? And then he says, sorry if that sounds like a cynical Cohen. And I think this is a really good question. I guess it probably gets to the heart of why I felt strongly enough about that to write a blog post about it. Because I read, you know, celebrities say asinine things every day of the year. If you wanted to make a job out of that, you could read entertainment news, and you could find something really idiotic coming out of the mouth of a celebrity every day. And I usually ignore it, and I usually don't say anything about it. But I think it's this risk that Mike is getting at that particularly gets my attention. It's bad when one guy says it, but what if that idea were to take hold, right? What if a lot of people were to get the idea that, yeah, maybe half the planet we'd be better off if they were eliminated, because we'd have a more sustainable world. Now, is that
That's sort of, you know, if you've got to get enough people that embrace that idea, then what, you know, you end up with genocide. I mean, you know, you have one culture that'll look at the world and say, okay, we're the good people. We're the people that need to stay. And they'll pick out some minority with, you know, and start persecuting them. It's how bad things get started. You know, you start with a bad idea and it infects enough people, and then you know you go to horrible places with something like that. You know, we're talking the Holocaust. That's the ultimate evil that can be done with bad memes would be something like the Holocaust.
It is. When you look at something like, I mean, and Will had brought up National Socialism. When you look at something like the Holocaust, you see there the very dark end of ideas that reproduce themselves. Whatever role the people who were carrying them out played in choosing them or in being carried along by them willingly, that's where it ends up. And I studiously avoided making a Nazi comparison in commenting on Jeremy Irons, but that, you know, Stephen, you're right. I mean, that's where you end up. That's where the idea that it would be okay if something horrible happened to half the population of the earth. I mean, it's on the same footing morally.
You know, and what, how do you combat bad ideas? You know, Thomas Jefferson, and many other founders had the idea that what we want in the United States is a open marketplace of ideas. That was the phrase that was used, marketplace of ideas. And the idea is that, you know, we're going to allow people to have freedom of speech. And if you say something really stupid and asinine, then the best way to combat that is, you know, for Phil to write a blog post calling you a nitwit. You know, that's the way you combat bad ideas, is that, you know, there are responses to these bad ideas. And when Thomas Jefferson founded the University of Virginia, he stated, this institution will be based on the illimitable freedom of the human mind. For here, we are not afraid to follow truth wherever it may lead, nor to tolerate any error so long as reason is left free to combat it. So,
wow.
I mean, it's this idea that we're going, you know, no matter how scary, you know, how many sacred cows get slaughtered, we're going to go after truth. And that was his idea with the University of Virginia. And it was the world's first secular university. It was not based on any church or religious model at all. And really a model for secular universities that followed that.
How about that? Thomas Jefferson. And so his answer is, if you got a bad meme, the answer is more memes. The answer to bad ideas is more ideas. Let's get some good ideas in. And I think that's right. And that brings us back to, so how do we start a meme? How do we get good ideas out there? Well, that actually takes me to the second of the two videos that were talked about in the post from last month, and that's from Susan Blackmore, who has written one of the definitive books on the subject of memetics. And in this TED Talk, she is laying out what she calls the third replicator. So the first replicator is genes. The second one is the first replicator, I guess, would be our genetic machinery, and what's reproduced is genes. The second replicator is human culture, and what's reproduced is memes. And then the third replicator she calls teams, and these are technological memes. Now, I didn't grasp exactly what she was getting at, and I want to thank our reader Naomi Most, who set me straight on what exactly Blackmore meant by this. When she's talking about teams, it's T-E-M-E-S, teams, not like T-E-A-M-S. She's talking about ideas that are reproduced, or information that is reproduced within a machine substrate. Okay, so once human in a technological substrate without human interaction. Okay, so those are teams, and of course we know those are possible on the bad side from stuff like computer viruses, but there are also good applications of that kind of capability where actually some of the things that fight viruses work a lot like that, reproducing themselves in order to act as sort of a defense system or almost an immune system for computer systems, keeping them safe from infection. So that's kind of the third one. But I took this diversion from there, and it's like sometimes it's useful not to know what you're talking about. And here's my evidence of that
this is very interesting. The unintentional tangent was pretty fruitful, I thought. Go ahead.
I thought so too. So I tried to break it down. I'm like, well, okay, so a meme is an idea, and then a team is a technological meme. I decided that we had just had this discussion about capability a couple weeks ago, and I had done a longer post on that just about 2 weeks ago. I said, let's compare, and I called them teams, and that's not really what they are, so we'll just call these capabilities versus ideas. And using the same time scale that we used to trace the history of human capability, I said, well, let's look at a major capability and a major idea or expression just of information from 20,000 years ago. And I said, okay, well, a capability would have been how to build a fire. A meme would have been cave paintings. We talked about cave paintings as one of the ways of encoding information at that time. 5,000 years ago, a capability, the wheel. The meme would be the story of the first guy who ever got run over by a wheel. No doubt that spread pretty rapidly. In fact, even if no one ever got run over, that story probably spread pretty rapidly because one of the great things about memes is you have these wonderful urban legends that develop, stories that reproduce themselves irrespective of truth content, as we see demonstrated over in Snopes.com. 500 years ago, I noted the Gutenberg printing press as the capability and the Gutenberg Bible as the result of that. 100 years ago, the electric light bulb, or the idea that got reproduced, Darwin's Origin of Species. In this world that we live in today, I list it as a capability, movable type software, or the ideas would be such as what you read in The Speculist. And then moving
type software.
What's that?
Which is written with movable type software. So
exactly, yeah. And some of these go together and some don't. So
yeah.
Some of them are kind of a set and then some aren't. And then into the future, the space elevator, I listed as a capability, a technological implementation of capability. And then the meme, this is where the lines start to blur, uploaded copies of ourselves. Because if we have that capability of uploading ourselves and copying ourselves, or if you have a freestanding copy of Stephen Gordon living in the computer substrate that can make additional copies of itself, I think at that point you've got a team the way Susan Blackmore would use the idea, right?
Yeah. Okay.
You're out of just the realm of information. But all that's to say that I think there really is a meaningful distinction between information that reproduces itself and capabilities or practices that have reproduced themselves throughout our history. So one of my responses to how do you start a meme is actually build a better mousetrap. One way to start a meme is to invent something, either to actually build something new that has never existed before, or create a new capability, a new interesting application of technology that already exists. If you do something that hasn't been done before, you've actually potentially started a meme. What will make it a meme in the long run, I guess, is whether other people decide that they're going to pick it up too.
Right.
Now, on the idea side, it's very much the same thing, and this is where we get into to what Thomas Jefferson was suggesting. So if people are if we're concerned that people might adopt this idea, this nitwit idea, that half the population of the world ought to vamoose, that we'd be better off if something terrible happened to them, how do we counter that? Well, the answer to a bad idea is a good idea. And so that's where we come in with our own ideas about what needs to happen in the world. And that's where we put out things such as a video I did a couple weeks ago, The Three Wishes, in which I describe a very different set of scenarios for how the future might go. And in that future, nobody has to get killed in order for us to have a sustainable future. And in fact, in the future that we talk about consistently on this program and on the blog, we can achieve a very clean, very sustainable economy and planet, not through renunciation of technology, much less through killing people or having people die out, but rather through developing new technology.
Right. Right. And you know, I know that you've done a lot of traveling in your life, Phil, but I mean, in the places that you have gone that are most developed technologically, in your estimation, do they tend to be more or less environmentally friendly than the poorest places the least developed places that you've gone? What's been your experience in that? Because I can tell you what my experience has been.
Yeah, the thing is, there's this continuum from if you've got no technological development at all, which it's hard to find people like that, then actually your environmental footprint's pretty good if you're living in the rainforest or something like that. But of the places I've been in my life, the least far advanced people I've seen, right, have been stuck in the early to middle part of the 20th century. And what does that mean? Well, that means people who are back at that stage are dumping all kinds of junk into the air, into the water. They're throwing garbage around. There's no question that once you move out of that kind of early industrial mode into a more prosperous and a more highly technologically efficient mode, you start taking better care of the environment. The two things go together. I mean, we've talked about this, that really, in a sense, environmental concern is kind of a luxury that more advanced technological cultures indulge themselves with. Now, I don't really think it's just a luxury. I don't think it's an indulgence the way, you know, a swimming pool is or something like that.
Well,
I think
we can afford to care, you know?
Right.
I mean, if those countries that are just trying to scrape by, they really can't afford to care, and so it's, I agree, it's not exactly a luxury. It's not, we do ourselves well when we take care of the planet that we're living on, you know. I mean, it's not exactly a luxury. It's more of just, you know, it's in a way it's self preservation, but it's, you know, you can worry about 100 years from now what the Earth will look like once the needs of today have been met, and for large parts of the world that are pre-industrial or just still within early industrial development, they really don't have their needs for today and for this week and for this year met. They can't really think about. They really can't think the long term that's required to take care of the planet. So
that's right. And ultimately,
it doesn't make them bad people. I'm not suggesting that they're bad folks. It just comes down to you do what you can to get by and under those circumstances. So,
well, to me, it goes back to the idea that this is not a popular meme. So I haven't heard a lot of people repeat this. And as far as I know, I'm the first person to say it, although I'm sure someone else has said it much more lucidly and eloquently than I have. But I am increasingly convinced that technology enables virtue. Okay. So it's not that they're bad people. It's actually not that we're good people. It's that we got far enough along that we can afford to take that step. The other analogy I give for this is that suddenly Europe got over its desire to buy and sell human beings when the industrial age took hold. That that slavery went away when there were suddenly it was capable there was a capability to automate all that work. Now, does that mean that the people who are arguing against slavery weren't right? Of course they were right. Was slavery wrong? It was absolutely wrong. But the virtue of recognizing that it's wrong and making that a societal norm was enabled by the technology. And I think the virtue, which is a true virtue and is really good behavior, of taking good care of the planet has been enabled by our technological development and by the prosperity that that has provided for us. So, not only is it not a matter of we shouldn't condemn them because they're not bad people, it's like we probably shouldn't give ourselves all that much credit. I mean, yes, we're doing the right thing, but we're only able to do the right thing because we've taken it to this point. So I think there's a great way to picture the world, which is to take that same idea and push it forward. Because as we've mentioned in previous weeks, and actually as we're always talking about, human capability is just on the edge of exploding. It's just about to become much greater than it's ever been before. We're really in the shallow end of the pool here in terms of what human beings are capable of doing. And there's always this fear that if you make people very powerful, that they're going to be capable of doing all this great evil, and that there's a significant risk to that. But I think history actually shows a fairly good track record of give us more capability, and we make better choices, and we do better things. I think we can make a really amazingly wonderful world, a world that's not overcrowded, because there's actually plenty of room for everyone, that has plenty of resources, that is cleaner than we can possibly imagine today, full of healthy, rich, sexy, immortal billionaires with superpowers, enjoying basically what we would view from this side of the chasm, limitless abundance. And to me, that's a better idea, okay? Not just because it's mine, but that's a better idea than thinking that half the population of the world needs to die, right? You know, I mean,
yeah, perhaps we can afford to let them stay. You know, maybe we don't have to.
Let's sharpen our pencils and see if we can't, come up with a scheme where everybody gets to stick around. I'm just throwing it out there.
Not to be too judgmental, Jeremy, but maybe there's a way we can figure it out.
Yeah, rethink it. Just rethink.
I want to throw this out here just real quick. We're almost out of time, but I wanted to kind of brag on my son, Matthew. He got a chance to participate in a program called Starbase at the local Air Force base, where he went, and one of the big things they did, they had these computer CAD CAM programs. They would design something in 3D and then print it out on a fab lab right in the classroom.
How cool!
That was, and he comes to me. And he had in his hand a little space capsule that it was printed out and that he had made into a keychain. And he holds it up and he says, "Dad, this is a pretty big deal." He looks at me, and I got from that. I knew exactly what he meant. Not just the little plastic thing he was holding, but the very fact that he could do it. Here he is. He's in the fifth grade, and he's doing something like that. That's where the world's going.
Matthew totally gets it. He totally gets it.
He gets it. He's only in the fifth grade, but he gets it.
He gets it. If Jeremy Irons could understand what a big deal that is, I think he might start to get it too. But we can't all be as bright as a fifth grader. Certainly not your kid. That's the real challenge. So yeah, good for Matthew figuring that out, and he said it better than I did in an hour. That's exactly right. It's a big deal.
Yeah.
All right. Well, with that, I guess we should switch to the music.
Yeah, tonight, I'm Having a Great Day comes to us from the Alice Project.
The Alice Project? I believe we've heard from them before.
Yes, we have. They're regifting for the holidays.
That's right. Okay, singing I'm Having a Great Day. Great title. Thanks for putting that together. Stephen, thank you all for listening to us, those listening live, those listening via recording. Thanks for being part of Fast Forward Radio. We'll be back again next week, and until then, live to see it.
Oh. Having a great day.